two things that we hope are related, that are each most interesting if they are related. The multimuon signal at CDF but not T0, and the possibility that Suzy, very low mass natural Suzy, could be hidden in plain sight in some unusual decay modes. So I'm going to start out by just talking about multimuons and the D0 distributions that they put out. Yes, it was the last week, 2 weeks ago. Then I'm going to talk about hiding Suzy. And then, are they related? All right, so I want to start by just summarizing the how this purported signal was identified. So CDF has a tracker with six layers, and they start from, I guess, in radius, a 1.5 centimeter layer, inner layer. Then there are two inner layers and four more layers going out to a distance of 10 or so centimeters. And they look at, they have two different ways of two different requirements for tracks. There's a tight sample where they require hits to be reconstructed in the two inner layers and then any two additional layers, say, might miss these two, but that would be reconstructed as a tight track. And then they also look at loose tracks where they just require three hits somewhere in the detector, not necessarily the inner layers. And in each case, they reconstruct an impact parameter, which is just the distance of closest approach of the track to the collision spot. So tight requires 2 plus 2 hits, and loose just 2 inner plus 2 more. Loose just requires 3 hits. And what do they find? They find that their tight sample is pretty well described by a sort of soup of QCD events that they've modeled. And they show plots of this in the papers out to 0.4 centimeters of impact parameter. So this is where their fits stop. But basically, their QCD model and their data agree out to here. They have, in some units, log scale. Number of counts is like almost 10 to the 7 per 0.08 centimeters? No. Events. And then out here where they're showing agreement, it's gone down to something less than 10 events per minute. And then there are a few straggler events down below. So they think they understand this tight signal, and then they look at the loosely reconstructed muon sample. And they first normalize this tight sample, their QCD, to get the right rate of the tight sample, and draw a conclusion about how many QCD events should be in the loose sample. So that gives them their QCD prediction. What they find out here, where they stop modeling, is about a factor of 20 higher at 2 10 to the 2. So the actual data goes out. They start losing statistics, but there's clearly some excess out at impact parameters of 1 to 2 centimeters.
This is just the loose cuts.
Yeah.
And the tight cuts agree for the short impact.
Yeah. So this is
parameter, they have the same rates.
Essentially. So this is, but this is tight times a constant, think they know that constant pretty well based on the efficiencies. At least morally, this is correct. And then what they call ghost events. What they call ghost events is the difference between their tight, between their loose sample and what they expect from the tight sample. Or what they expect from their QCD soup normalized to the tight sample. And that follows here, oddly, right around the point where it's crossing, where the QCD sample is comparable to what their order one compared to what the QCD expectation is order one compared to what they're seeing, this difference starts going up. So the subtraction doesn't just look like some smooth exponential impact parameter difference. It actually starts picking up here. And it's not clear whether this is an indication of some source of background or some kinematic effect, or what exactly it might be. But in any case, they see this excess.
How can loose give fewer events than tight?
This is trying to draw white on white chalk. Loose is my first dashed line, and this new line here, this is loose minus some constant times tight.
Oh, okay.
But this constant is supposed to be like a 1/1 efficiency. And really this is constant times QCD Monte Carlo. But they've tested that QCD Monte Carlo matches the tight out to a point where it's negligible. So I'll just be sloppy. Morally, it's loose minus constant times tight. So the number of events that they see in this ghost, this is definition of the ghost sample, is loose minus normalization times tight. It's several times 10 to the 5 events. But if they were to, if you were to just extrapolate this exponential down, say this is probably some background, then you would get a lower number, sort of ten to the four to 10 to the 5 range. And if you fit this exponential, you get a C tau of about 0.6 centimeters. Okay. Is this on?
Did you do the effect display?
Probably not. Well, all right. Before that,
sometimes if you unplug it and replug it,
Oh well. Let's see.
For a second there.
There's back again.
Okay. So these purple lines are their tight samples, and the tight sample in the QCD Monte Carlo, and then this blue, the black data points are ghost defined this way. Blue is my attempt to add ghost to QCD to get back what their total distribution of the loose sample actually looked like. And I haven't shown it here. This is just for two muon events. But they get very similar, when they do this procedure of subtracting a QCD Monte Carlo, they get very similar distributions for 2 mu and for 3 mu. So they have a large enough sample of 3 muon events, they can study the impact parameter of the muons there. And in that case, I should say they're doing all of this on a done muon trigger. So they require 2 muons with pt greater than 3 dev. In these 3 muon events, 2 of those are going to be the ones they triggered on and one of them isn't. And again, they see very similar shapes for the triggered muon or muons that didn't trigger. what this would seem to suggest is that there's some excess tracks that for there are some sources, several sources of tracks that don't contribute to the tight sample ever because they're actually produced outside at distances larger than than the radius of the inner tracker. So if they're produced at distances outside 1.5 centimeters, that track can't hit something with a radius of 1.5 centimeters. There's plenty of things that can do that. You have fakes. You have decays and flights of kaons and pions. But at least...
Is that consistent with this bit that C tau is 0.6 centimeters?
Those things... So... There, you mean, do the known source, standard model-like sources give you the same
C-tau?
No, I'm just
asking a very naive question. 0.6 centimeters is less than 1.5 centimeters.
Right.
So if your explanation for why these are happening is that they're happening outside the you know, 1.5 centimeters, do you still expect to get such a small impact parameter?
So,
I know
they're
not
the
same thing, but they're
so
correlated.
If
right?
there's, yeah, so if, let's say these things are produced with a typical boost of... 5, then you'd really expect the typical distance before decay to be much larger than, to be roughly 5 times this. So you're really in the regime where these only contribute to the loose sample. If their typical boost is more like 2, so sort of an order 1 fraction of them decay inside, an order 1 fraction decay outside, then you would still expect the fraction that decay outside to give you loose events but no tight events.
I thought that the C tau there was the tau was the lab frame one because this is really an exponential against distance, right?
Yeah,
so you're
okay.
I have some decay length and I thought it was just sort of roughness and you've got C tau and that's the length.
Yeah,
so you've got a decay length, not a decay time. So if there's different gammas, I would expect a non exponential distribution.
Yeah, so the thing to remember about this is that the more boosted, so you are reconstructing not the displacement of the vertex, which does grow with gamma. But you're actually not able to reconstruct the vertex from a single track. When you look at the impact parameter, let's say you have some very boosted particle. Then its decay products are also expected to lie in a boosted cone. So they're almost always quite forward. And when you extrapolate their momentum back, you end up to your original vertex. You end up with an impact parameter that's much, much less by roughly 1 over gamma. It's much, much less than the vertex displacement. So that 1 over gamma, I mean, there's beta dependence, but the limit of beta is close to 1. That 1 over gamma exactly cancels the gamma C tau, the gamma that goes in the decay lifetime.
So the impact parameter ends up being something like the Lorentz invariant, almost. It's kind of cute.
At least in the limit of relativistic things. So CDF sees this kind of excess in 2 muon events and in 3 muon events. And so D0 went back and tried to reproduce roughly the same calculation. And what they say is that there is a loose selection distribution. There is a tight, and then they normalize that to their tight distribution. They subtract them, and they see no excess.
But all the black points are above the red.
Well, so they see that difference is about 700 events. All of them same sign events. It's a little weird.
So loose and tight also means roughly what it
roughly.
Means.
Roughly, there are some potentially important differences. They're calculating the background in a slightly different way, but I think it's actually equivalent. The main difference that is probably worth paying attention to is that D0 has fewer tracking layers. And so I said so D0 has just, I don't remember, 5, I think. But in any case, their loose definition is morally the same as CDF's. They require 3 hits. Their tight definition is one inner head plus two more heads. So at D0, the loose and the tight tracks are both requiring three heads. Whereas at CDF, the tight one requires four heads total. So you would expect some things to contribute very differently, too. But so D0, again, they start from about, in their case, 1.6 centimeters. They have extra layers. And the tight sample requires a hit here. So it should be corresponding to things produced inside 1.6 centimeters. For a tight. But D0 tight is a weaker requirement than CDF tight. Now, what I find striking about and puzzling about the result, and this is also the reason I didn't cancel my talk here when they released this. See, the way I would have expected D0 to be able to refute CDF's excess is that they say, okay, we do this calculation. We have a tight sample. It looks a lot like CDF's tight sample. We have a loose sample. So they both fall off like this, right around, you know, sharply down to almost nothing at about 0.5 centimeters impact parameter. If this were their tight sample, if this were their loose sample, they see very little difference, and it can all be accounted for by the standard model. That would be a pretty convincing indication to me that these CDF high-impact parameter events were probably just bogus. But that's not what happened. What happened is that D0 sees the same elongated tail in their loose sample that CDF does. They just subtract that same tail away because they also see that tail in their tight sample. So it's a bit confusing how... what is the source of all these events with the 1 centimeter displaced muons, 1 centimeter impact parameters in their tight sample? That should be...
Does TCD predict their tight sample? I'm still confused on that.
Well, they don't go into that in their note. They're just doing a purely data-driven analysis, which is nice, but...
Idea for, I mean, on these plots, the blue, I mean, so you're saying there's a discrepancy in their tight selection, is one way to say it, right?
Yeah.
So if you look, the red is the tight selection of D0, and you're saying the blue is the fit to CDF, so the difference between the blue and the red is what I should see as the discrepancy between the tight samples?
Well, the difference between the red and the pink, or CDF's red. So this is CDF tight sample. This is D0's tight sample.
Their tight samples
are very different. Their loose samples are very similar. So it's true that they don't... CDF sees an excess, and they do not see an excess. But they are seeing the same kind of high-impact parameter rates.
Yeah. So... yeah, part of it could be that they have a lot more material in their tracker, a lot more muscle scattering. So extrapolating back, I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud here. Why is it so different?
Yeah.
Tight sample?
I don't know.
That's the question. I mean, unless they Monte Carlo it with their detector, you don't know quite what to think, right?
Yeah. What strikes me is that, I mean, I can think of effects like fake tracks. Let's say that really all these events are fake tracks. Then I might expect it to be, you know, it's relatively easy to have fake tight tracks in D0 compared to CDF, for example. That would be qualitatively consistent. But it wouldn't give you the same impact parameter slope at D0 than at CDF, I would expect, because that depends on, you know, the details of the material, the detailed layering of the tracker. I literally just fit line segments to this, and the scale is, the overall normalization is different, but the shape is identical.
Is there any plan to, like Jack was asking, to you could take the same Monte Carlo, at least, that fits one of these guys, let's say D0, and run that same model through the CDF detector, or just run the same model through both detectors to see if detector effects are different. And as John said, there's more material in D0, things like that. Do you think that's...
Yeah, I don't know of any plans to do that. I do know that the D0 group that did this analysis is still doing the analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And they are...
Have you talked to them?
I have not talked to them. I've talked to other D0 people who have talked to them. But
you don't
yeah.
know who it is, do you?
We could go to the name of the guy who gave the talk.
Yeah.
Right now. And Morion.
Williams?
His last name
right?
is Williams.
Williams,
yeah. I don't know him at all.
We heard about this at CMS week, so we haven't had a chance to look at their stuff at all.
Uh-huh.
I looked at their talk, or, you know.
Yeah.
This is the right question.
Yeah, they did not... They
so there's one way you could say that they confirmed the results.
Yeah, I mean, they...
our pick.
I mean, they confirm it in a way that leaves it open. So there are two possibilities. These are some high-impact parameter reconstructed tracks are really there. Something's producing them. I can now say that with confidence.
But their selection requires the innermost layer.
Yeah. So, I mean, at least their impact parameter reconstruction on the tight does cut off sharply at 1.5, as it must. But...
Cannot CDF maybe reproduce these zero results just by demanding one in the
I would be interested to see that. Or to see CDF require, you know, their two inner, or, you know, any kind of modification to, without change, just things like requiring four tracks, but not caring where in the detector they are. Or... Sorry, four hits or three hits. It's requiring one of them to be inner. That might shed some light on this.
Well, wasn't there something about D0 having some muon timing that CDF didn't have so that they could eliminate cosmics and such?
Yeah, but again, this
that
isn't...
put into this
that,
analysis?
I believe so. The CDF analysis removes the cosmics just by required... by cutting out just by cutting out a case where you have two muons that are literally back to back, within a tiny angle. D0 does it with timing, but again, having removed removing part of the data set from CDF wouldn't give you these two distributions. So my two conjectures about what this could be is either that it's some fake effect that's just there no matter what you do, but dramatically reduced when you require four hits instead of three. It's one possibility. The other possibility is that it's actually pretty easy to fake a D0 tight track. That is, you have a real highly displaced track origin, but that track gets sort of randomly associated with something in the inner layer, and...
Is there a requirement that, maybe in that respect, is there a requirement that that innermost track line up, has to line up to some degree with the other tracks, right? And
well, I think they
pattern.
Always do that in reconstruction,
yeah.
But I don't know the details.
In some sense, the only way to understand is that you have a whole bunch of stuff hanging between the first and second layer of CDF. Is that right?
I guess that would... But that should also decay outside of D0. It would have to decay between 1.5 and 1.6 centimeters.
Saying,
okay,
yes.
Yeah.
Circle is it what?
Yeah,
there's two circles there.
Yeah.
If it decays between the two circles, then
I don't know. You guys should tell me. 1.5, I believe.
Around
1.5
centimeters.
And the outer one, then?
You mean
of
this?
Those two circles.
Of the two inner layers?
Two circles. Because there's only. Well, the next circle out is like a. Now I'm getting confused. Yeah, layer 0.0 ranges
yeah.
from 1.2 to 1.5 centimeters radius because it's flat, you know.
Oh, right.
Slabs. But then the inner layer of the SVX, called layer 0, is further out, like about 2.5 centimeters.
I see, so it's even worse than what I was saying. The two inner layers are the same, more or less the same.
Well, yeah,
and,
so...
And the second track is actually further out than the D0 equivalent layer, right? The second CDF hit is further out than the inner, or
yeah.
the single layer of
D0.
Yeah. Is D0 right. using their new inner layer?
Mm-hmm.
So to get two hits on the inner... It's two slabs overlapping.
No.
How do you get? Can you explain what two hits on the inner track are?
Well, it's the layer 0.0 and the layer 0, right? So
there are two concentric
layers.
You
require a hit in the one from 1.2 to 1.5 and a hit in the 2 centimeter layer. Which, you know, as far as where the track has to originate, is equivalent to requiring a hit in the single layer, the one layer at 1.6 centimeters.
This doesn't make sense, this red D0 thing.
Yeah.
Just geometrically cut off much faster than that. Right?
Well, they...
A track with an impact parameter of 1.5 with a hit on the inner layer at 1.5
should...
There
yeah.
hardly any phase space for that.
I
so
agree.
That really...
yeah.
But this is what they measure.
Well, so now they
so
are
they
are multiplying each event by an efficiency, by a sort of 1 over efficiency factor, as they would need to. But it's not an efficiency that depends on impact parameter. It's an efficiency that just depends on the PTs and the ETAs. And it looks really flat, and all the distributions they put in their talk look flat. So they might as well be multiplying by a constant.
Yes, I guess it's really what I did say is that there has to be some extra events that emerge only after 1.5 centimeters or so.
What, and only in CDF?
No, D0 doesn't know what
they suddenly
emerge after 1.6 centimeters.
Yeah,
right?
Actually, I mean,
all
L0.
Between 1.5, 1.2, and 1.0. Anyway.
L0 is anywhere from 1.62 to 1.78. It's staggered.
Okay.
Is that
why
the second layer or
the first
layer?
First layer at D0.
So there may be up to 0.28 centimeters. Presumably.
Yeah, so if any of you have great ideas for what experimental artifacts would generate this, I'd be very interested to hear it. But I hope I have at least convinced you that the D0 result is... as understood currently, doesn't make enough sense to kill CDF. And I'm allowed to continue.
So is it possible that the efficiency that they use to get that pink curve in CDF is just off?
Well, except
the normalization
to
be off,
yeah.
But...
Well, no, I mean, the tight sample has an efficiency factor.
Yeah, so they but...
No, it's a raw number of events.
But the QCD fit has to include the
I mean, yeah,
right?
Some of they fix the number of QCD events that they put in so that when you multiply by the tight efficiency, you get the right number of tight events. So there's some implicit dependence on that efficiency. But that rescaling that, you know, would be nowhere near, might be able to get rid of this little tail of junk up here, but it's really nowhere near sufficient to get rid of the tail.
Oh, there's an impact.
I mean, this
dependent efficiency
here, where they're beyond what they model in their Monte Carlo. I mean, this is a factor of 20 up here. And down at 0, they differ by about 10%. So it's a lot to account for.
But which part of the QC modeling is it sensitive to? It's not, it's all the stringy stuff that they put in the DI.
I don't think so. I mean, it's mainly it's the different, you know, they have to fit to the impact observed impact parameter distributions to get the relative rates of you know, the overall normalization of the beat cross section, the charm cross section, and scale each one appropriately. I think that's the main thing that goes into the model. Anyway, I hope D0 can tell us more about their tight events soon. But for now, I'll go with what I have. So I just want to summarize before moving on to completely unrelated Suzy phenomenology that tying them together. Summarize some features of the CDF excess that, at least to me, are the sort of really striking things that are important to explain if you have a new physics guess, because they're sort of surprising looking. So one is this impact parameter. And so I'm decaying at 0.6 centimeters. Then the second sort of odd thing about these events is that you can look, and I guess I'll show you guys the real plots, and then draw sketches for the rest of the talk. I'll use the sketches. Just so you know that I'm not making it up. So they look at the mass, at invariant mass distributions of all tracks in their events. This is after certain requirements of free muons, so they think it's a cleaner sample of whatever the signal events are. And they have this mass distribution that is not peaked very low. In fact, it's peaked out at about 50 GeV. And then it falls very slowly. So that by 100 GeV or so, it's really only fallen by about a factor of 2. And there's events all the way out to, you know, 200 or so. When they look at the mass of just the muons in these events, of course it's smaller because there are a lot more tracks than muons, but it has the same sort of qualitative shape. It peaks around 30, and by double that, twice as far out, it's fallen by about a factor of 2. Now, these are very slowly falling distributions, and in particular, two things that they're definitely not consistent with. So a resonance would get smeared out a little, even if it was very narrow, but it would still retain any kind of production process that you can imagine. It would still have some relic of that resonant mass scale, and expect a peak really out an order of one fraction of the way.
Meaning a resonance is shooting in the direction.
If you have some resonance that produces, so you're resonantly producing some Z prime that magically produces multi muons.
Okay.
That you'd expect to see some trace of that in these mass distributions. Again, it might be significantly broadened. If you have missing energy, the shape might change, but it shouldn't be peaked down at halfway below the mean. So it's not a resonant.
By the way, if I remember rightly, CDF never plotted their di muon mass distributions.
For the two initial muons, they do not. For muons within a single cone, they do. So I haven't gotten to cones yet. But they do look at those, and
there's no structure.
Not much structure. There's, so it's not a resonance. It's also not some normal production. If you put in either production through a photon or production through any sort of matrix element that just has angular dependence, but isn't very dependent on set of pair production of some new particle that doesn't have a lot of center mass energy dependence. So photon would go like 1 over s, or anything that goes like s to the 0 times angular stuff, would really fall off much more quickly. So no single process can account for the whole mass distribution. If m squared goes like 1 over s, or s to the 0. One of the things that Paul Barbieri, Richkoff, and Strumia noticed in their paper was that the distribution is pretty well described if you use higher dimension operators that grow with energy for the production. Then the models that implement that have some problems. So the third thing they do, now this is the cones, is they look at three muon events where they tag two muons, and there's a third muon in the event. Let's say this is a mu plus and a mu minus. They look at some other mu minus and ask, what's the angle between the mu minus and the opposite sign compatriot? So that's the angle they plot. This is the cosine of that angle, and you see it's very peaked forwards, which means that there's roughly some cone around your initial muon where other muons like to lie, and there's also a backward peak, which you can interpret as being the cone of the other muon. But the fact that this is still pretty narrow is an indication not only that your muons like to align with one another in cones, but that these two cones are more or less back-to-back. So, in this theta distribution, with a sharp peak that tells you muons are in cones, and a smaller peak at negative cos theta that tells you they're back to back.
The initial two muons are the most energetic ones, or
there is a higher energy requirement on the two initial muons, but. I think that the trigger may not, if you have three muons that all pass that threshold, I don't know which ones the trigger picks. Some of the time it just, the trigger efficiency is low enough that some of the time it's almost certainly not going to pick the two hardest, even if that's what it tries to do. Then the fourth striking thing, and the reason they call them multi-muons, is they look at one of these cones and ask how many muons are in a cone. And the numbers go up so they have statistically significant counts of up to four to five muons in a cone. So they have 120 events with five muons, they have 120 plus or minus 50 events, sort of marginally significant. And they have 750 4 mu events, and that's 5 sigma, and then on up with their 3 mu, 2 mu. And this is in a single cone, there's always at least one muon outside of that cone. So this, 5 mu, that means it's really a 6 muon event. So on all of these ratios, by the way, aside from the 1 muon to 2 muon ratio, they're all about 15% to 20%. So what's the probability if you have two muons within a cone, what's the probability of seeing a third? It's about 15%. Likewise, once you have three, the probability of seeing a fourth is again another 15%. This suggests, but if you look at one muon, that's what's the probability of seeing a second muon in that cone. It's much lower. It's like 3%. So that suggests that these one muon events may have lots of background. but these others all seem to have a common, the others may all have a common source that has a pretty high efficiency for producing additional muons. And they have a very complicated plot in the paper, which I've probably complicated more with my legends. but this is trying to show the number of events with in a given cone, how many muons there are and what signs they are. So for example, these two dots up at around 10 to the 4 correspond to two muons with either opposite signs or the same sign. And one thing you notice is that they have remarkably similar rates. So that's surprising. I should also say, remarkably similar rates for same sign or opposite sign muons, as though there's either a production process that produces two same sign muons, but since they don't reconstruct anything, more likely that they're all coming from independent places. But rather than having some x that goes to mu plus mu minus 7% of the time, you might have some x that goes to mu, but when it does, it always goes to mu plus mu minus. Some x that goes to yy of order 100% of the time, and then y goes to mu plus invisible, y plus 1 minus. Y goes to mu plus invisible about 15% of the time. And that might seem a little ad hoc, except that we have a y in the standard model, which is the tau. And all of the mass scales in these two or more muon events, you can look at invariant masses within a single cone. All of that, those seem sort of plausibly consistent with the process that would have enough energy to create taus. So it's not crazy to try to say that we have some new particle x decays to tau tau, and all these multi-muon events are really multi-x events with the right distribution. And all of the relative frequencies of different signs for the same total number of muons, the relative frequencies of different numbers of muons are all at least roughly consistent with that if you assume that you're producing between 3 and 5 x's on each side of the event in every cone. And this is in every event. And this is something that the experimentalist that wrote the sort of first phenomenological study noticed immediately. So that's been known for a long time. This is just the thing I was saying earlier about a good description to the events being given by some dimension 5 operator. This is, in fact, remarkably good. But, okay, so those are all the figures I want to talk about in the data. I guess the one other thing worth mentioning about these muon multiplicities, so these 3 muon a cone really means it's a 4 muon event. You might ask, are those more or less frequent than events with 2 muons in each cone? Those are also 4 muon events. But they turn out to be quite comparable.
So what's a multiplicity at D0?
They decided that they would study multiplicities if they saw an excess in their impact parameter study. They didn't see an excess, so they did not. We can quibble about whether that was the right interpretation. But so they have not done that yet. All right, so I'll come back to these events later, but I want to talk about Susie now. And
by the way, don't worry about time.
You sure?
Yeah.
How much should I not worry about time?
Some of us who haven't had lunch, but you're going to get hungry too, so I think you should let your stomach do your job.
All right. Well, you guys should please feel free to rush me if you get hungry or bored. I completely understand. So, an idea that's been around for a long time is that Susie decays can be much, much more general than the kinds of things that most searches are done for. And I think this is, it can seem like a bit of a, you know, of a thrill to just try to find decays that are hidden, but it's really very important. And the reason for that is that there's a qualitative tension between what you would expect Susie events, what you would expect from the superpartner mass spectrum, and what you conclude from all the existing searches. So typically, you expect the Higgs soft mass square, at least for the uptype Higgs, to run from the top Yukawa, and come out, if you have running over a reasonably large range of scales, something comparable to the stop mass square, if the stop is light and you think flavor universality, minimal flavor violation are important principles, then that should also be comparable to the other spork mass squares. And then, again, because of RG evolution, you expect that to be comparable to the mass square of the galena. At least it receives large logarithmic corrections set by that. On the other hand, you look at the minimization of the Higgs potential, and you expect the Z mass squared to be of order the HM mass squared, unless there's some fine-tuning. Now, there could be fine-tuning in the spectrum, but if it's not fine-tuned, what you really would have expected to see is the Z at the top of the superpartner spectrum with the strongly interacting things, and weakly interacting things quite possibly lighter. But these can't all simultaneously be true. Let's set limits on neutralino and chargino masses roughly in the range of 100 GeV. Tevatron has set, both experiments have set limits on the masses of the sporks and the galenos very roughly around 300 GeV. And in addition, or worst of all, the Higgs mass has to be greater than, also from what? Greater than 114 GeV if it decays to BB bar. And it's well known, especially around here, that this is easy to evade, this Higgs bound. This is really easy to evade because that decay to BB bar is going through a Yukawa coupling of around 5%. So you really don't need very large couplings of the Higgs to something else to make this a pretty ineffective search channel. And if you just go to the most model-independent limit, where they just look at Z Higgs, look at the Z recoil, let the Higgs go to anything, they find, this is just an opal search, the mass of the Higgs has to be greater than 82 GeV. And although this is a small mass difference, because it's logarithmically sensitive, only logarithmically sensitive to the superpartner masses, this really relaxes the constraints. On the other hand, these Tevatron and Chargino bounds are still pretty constraining on the sort of qualitative expectation. The Z should be right around the same mass as the strongly interacting superpartners. Well, the Z is not at above 300 GeV. But the model-independent bounds on the scores of the galenos are also much weaker. So probably the most model-independent bound you can set on the scorp mass is coming from just the total hadronic cross-section at LEP. So it probably has to be above, I don't know, maybe 90 GeV. I haven't calculated that carefully. And the tightest bound on the gluon mass that's model independent comes from, not from direct production of the gluon at all, but from jet shape observables at LEFT. So that gives you a limit of about 50 GeV. So this sign, the model independent limits, look a lot more consistent with this sort of qualitative hope of low mass SUSY than the model dependent limits that are usually assumed. So that, I think, makes it extremely interesting to think about what could hide both the Higgs and superpartners, and what the other signatures of that would be, where to look for it. So this can be done in very simple ways within the MSSM, for example, adding R parity violation, adding a few extra singlets. This can hide the event somewhat, but what I think is actually quite interesting is the possibility that Susie and Higgs events are really radically altered by the presence of some new sector. These sectors may be suggested by dark matter, but what I think is really striking is that there's good reason to think that if there's some new low-energy gauge groups around, if the universe isn't just SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, it's quite likely that the first place you'd be able to discover those new gauge groups is by producing superpartners and watching them go into the other sector. But these events look completely different from what we're used to from SUSY, possibly a lot more like the multi-muon events. So the basic setup, to imagine that you have your MSSM with all the gauge bosons, gauginos, leptons and quarks, etc. And then there's some other stuff with its own gauge groups, maybe its own matter. Who knows? I'm going to call it the dark sector, primarily because it doesn't see it doesn't interact with photons or directly with anything else at low energies that interacts with photons. So it's dark over there, and I'm going to assume that there's no new massless states in this dark sector. So the simplest thing I could do is just this sort of toy U1 version of the MSSM, which is to say that we have some dark photon and then up and down type Higgses plus all their superpartners. So this is the simplest kind of dark sector you could imagine that would fit what I have in mind. One could certainly have generalizations with non-abelian gauge groups, with matter.
You're not imagining that. So, I mean, you know, we, David E. Kaplan and Catherine Zurich and I had these models where they're just like this, and there's some the dark matter is literally in the dark sector. And we, you know, thought a little bit about, you know, making these connections of this kind of phenomenology, but we just stopped because we didn't pursue it much more because there doesn't seem to be any missing energy in these events. And for us, there was the dark matter was literally in that sector, so there would be significant missing energy. So is that right? Are you just thing does not have missing energy, or
I think you could get away with some substantial amount of missing energy in this sector, as long as it's all collinear, because you're producing two back-to-back cones. There's a lot of opportunities to have missing energy that just cancels, either because basically because the missing energy in cone 1 and the missing energy in cone 2 are comparable. They're back-to-back. The claim that there's no missing energy in these events is also, I think at this point, it's lore, backed up by a few event displays. I don't know. Is there more than that?
Told us,
John?
Is that the argument?
That the... How well is it known how much missing energy might be in the ghost events?
I have yet to see a plot.
Okay.
There's just the statement that you got from Paolo, I guess.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah. Actually, they don't have calorimetry data for these events, right? So they wouldn't...
They try not to look at the calorimeter at all in this...
So they wouldn't have any idea whether there's missing energy, right? Can you reconstruct...
Well, it's always there along with that. The data record, but,
yeah.
Yeah. They haven't studied it in the sense of really calibrating, cross-checking it for this sample or whatever, but I don't see why it would be any different than any other sample. They just have a fundamental distrust of the calorimeter in that group.
I see. Yeah,
if we had multi towels or something like that, there should be a lot of.
There should be missing energy there too.
Energy,
yeah.
But and that should have some observable tail.
The other simple thing to look at is just the electromagnetic calorimeter is a lot more reliable than the hadron. So you could just look at the electromagnetic energy in the cone around the muon compared to the amount of track energy. And that should be very sensitive to whether it's a bunch of taus decaying or QCD fragmenting type jet.
Because the charged fractions are different?
Yeah, the charged fractions are very different.
Do you know if that's something they're looking at?
I don't. They've been asked.
So, if you have something like this, something that has been talked about a lot recently is mixing them by coupling, by just kinetically mixing the dark photon with our photon, and add some epsilon F mu nu. Dark mu nu kind of coupling. One can also talk about other marginal interactions. In particular, one that's interesting for this kind of decay story is quartic mixing between the dark Higgses and so I'll call our Higgses capital H and the other Higgses lowercase h dark. So you can also write down quartic mixing between any scalars. Mixing between scalars that get VEVs are much more interesting, so I'll focus on this one. And these are both effective. These can be generated together in a SUSY preserving way by just adding a WW dark term. They can also be generated in a SUSY breaking way with independent couplings. So what does this basic setup do with either one of these two operators? Well, let's say I have some SUSY production. Say I produce some luminos. And now the gluino decays into a standard molybdeno, two quarks. Normally we say this is the lightest R-odd particle, so it's exactly stable. But if this dark sector also has R-odd particles, then even in an R-parity preserving situation, you're going to have this beno decay, say, to a dark Higgs and a dark Higgsino through this kinetic mixing, or it can decay into the dark sector through this guy. Both of these give you, for reasonable sizes of mixing, give you much faster decays into the dark sector than you would get to the gravitino, even if the gravitino is light. So you would really expect some kind of decay like this into the dark sector to dominate for the standard model LSP. You can also have a situation where the gluino is the LSP itself. Since it's not stable, there's no problem with that. And then you can have decay directly to the dark phenol. So Now, what happens to all these dark sector states? Well, really, they go into some black box. What happens in there depends a lot on what we put in this box and what all its parameters are. But it's very easy to get high multiplicities and cascades, just like, you know, you look at any standard model particle. How high a multiplicity of standard model particles does it decay to? Well, eventually quite a few. And if you have no sort of, if you think the other sector might be more natural than ours, it doesn't have small mixing angles within that sector, then you might expect everything to happen very promptly. So you can get large multiplicity final states of different dark states. Where this process stops of prompt decays inside the dark sector is that there are some particles that just kinematically can't decay anymore. So, for example, so I'm going to call these guys my stable. And there's a whole bunch of them. The lightest particle. The lightest fermion. The lightest odd particle. All of these have symmetries that keep them from decaying. And then, also quite interestingly, the second lightest. So now, let's say the lightest particles are bosons. Any boson with mass less than twice the mass of the lightest particle is also not able to decay within the dark sector. So it may still have decays, but they have to go into the standard model, which has much lighter states, so those will be suppressed by these small epsilon couplings. Likewise, any fermion with mass less than three times the last mass of the lightest fermion, or mass less than the mass of the lightest fermion plus the mass of the lightest boson. So you get a whole menu of metastable states. And then the question is just, there's a question, how do these decay? But because they're suppressed by small couplings, it's pretty reasonable to assume that they might give you displaced vertices.
Why is the lightest R-odd particle not absolutely stable?
It is absolutely stable, unless it could decay to the Gravitino, if there is one.
Oh, okay. Fair.
And then, and standard model practice, this guy, you're right, is exactly stable. With reasonable couplings, even with a very low F scale, an LSP that light isn't going to decay inside the detector, so we should just call it stable as far as observation. So the dark LSP is effectively stable, whether or not there's a light gravitino. So without knowing the details, what do we know about how these things decay? Well, you're going to get high multiplicities from whatever cascade. Because all of these partial widths to go into the standard model are epsilon suppressed. Decays into hidden sector stuff aren't. That means you're really preferentially going to accumulate however many of these lightest things. So you get high multiplicities. You can easily get displaced vertices. And another important point is that these guys can be quite soft. So instead of ending up with a lot of relatively hard jets that you can tag on, hard leptons like you could with an R parity violating decay, you're going to relatively few things. The minute you get this high multiplicity, you're also the super partners, a lot of the decay products are also coming out very soft. And that means so they can be very, very sensitive to trigger biases. This is particularly true in a limit where you imagine that whatever decay chain is producing these guys, it is a bunch of sort of non-relativistic cascades. That is, there aren't huge mass splittings in the dark sector like there are in our sector. If they have matter, their Yukawa matrix is a lot closer to order unity coefficients than ours. Or it might all be gauge stuff and Higgs's. But without huge parametric separation, so that each of these decays, without any fine-tuning, is producing things that are pretty much that are non-relativistic or semi-relativistic in the rest frames of this first thing you produced. And in that case, these things really tend to be quite soft.
And they also have to be spherical.
It's also spherical in his rest frame. But now, so let's say that your typical decay product is, or your most interesting decay product is a muon, and the typical muon PT is like 500 MeV. This is what you'd get, for example, from the decay of a tau that's nearly at rest. Then if you ever want to trigger on that muon for your dimuon trigger, it has to get a boost from somewhere, and I'm saying it's not getting a boost from this cascade decay because everything's sort of order one-ish in there. So the only boost it can possibly get is from the momentum of that dark Higgs zeno. That means for this PT to trigger, you need to have a boost of the Higgs zeno greater than about 6-ish, roughly. And that boost of 6 is enough to give you, now in the lab frame, any muons that might have come from this decay all in a narrow cone. So even though it's an intrinsically spherical process in the rest frame of the thing that's decaying, very spherical, very non-relativistic, the trigger sculpting is giving you quite narrow cones, and it's also biasing you towards very unusual events. Not events where this thing is, well, they might be usual, they might be unusual. Events where that dark Higgs zeno has a big boost itself. So you can work out
these multi-muon events, I guess the preference would be for this HD tilde would be much lighter than the Bruno, which you also would argue shouldn't be all that heavy.
Well, so the first thing, just the so the HD tilde, you can talk that you can get have kinematic phase space to go to, you know, 8 taus with the minimum of about with a minimum of about 15 GeV of mass.
Mm-hmm.
Something like 30 GeV, you can write down something that doesn't look ridiculously contrived. And that still does give you a lot of room for the Guarino mass if you want to have this big phase space.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a bit of a tension, though, between the... a boost gives you a narrow cone, but it doesn't but you don't expect a boost from the Guarino decay to give you two back-to-back cones. You expect it, right? Because this Guarino is decaying, and then this Guarino is decaying in an uncorrelated way.
Right, and they're more or less produced at rest, typically.
Right.
Yeah,
so the way to get back-to-back cones is sort of simultaneously with the... is to go out now and say, actually, there isn't very much phase space between RLSP, between the production, and so in fact, I want to say all of this is non-relativistic, but the Guarino production matrix element has, or some other story that I need to invoke, is going to. Let me take a slightly easier case. I could have Skork production. Here's one thing that would work, except that it's probably excluded by lab. I could have Skork production. That's dominated by a dimension 5 operator at the Tevatron energies for a very light Skork. And then most of the time these Skorks are produced non-relativistic, but if the cross-section's big enough, you can live out on the tail. So So in other words, most of them are produced non-relativistic. They decay to a bunch of muons with energy less than 100 less than a GeV. We never know about those events. Nobody's looking for them. It's only on the tail of the CM energy distribution that you have a shot of producing these guys. So what you're actually sensitive to experimentally is some tail starting from boosted around 4, and these events all tend to be boosted. Then it's just a quantitative question. Can you produce enough? And also, in this same region, because your two squark boosts should really be back-to-back. So it's very much expected that if you can realize this scenario, you'd produce two back-to-back. In the events that trigger would contain two back-to-back cones, that would be quite narrow.
Is there any reason why you focus on squarks? I mean, the Galenos could be the same.
I picked squarks to get... because Gluino, there's this fact that the direct production matrix element for squarks can be dominated by a dimension 5 operator. That helps you, I mean, something that looks dimension 5 when you integrate out a heavier Gluino. That helps you get a big tail and a mass distribution much more consistent with what they're seeing. Now, unfortunately, I don't think there's a way of realizing this without putting your squarks so light that they screw up the LEP hadronic cross-section. So this is probably, it's a very nice idea that's probably no good for getting the two back-to-back cones. There is another way of trying to get this total mass shape, which is to say, actually, it's not just one process. That's why the reason it doesn't look like a single process with a flat matrix element is that it's two processes. So you can have a much lighter Gluino consistent with the LEP limits, slightly heavier squark, and roughly, here's the distribution they're seeing, the Gluino pair production fills out part of the distribution but falls off too sharply, but Gluino squark production sort of fills in the rest. And this looks like it may be not too far off the mark. So if you ask me what I think the most credible SUSY explanation for that signal would be, I'd probably start from this process. Just because the more aesthetically pleasing solution is completely ruled out by LEP. So that takes care of the kinematics, right? This hiding SUSY has a shot of giving you high multiplicities. I haven't tried to model this in detail. But it can give you back-to-back cones. It can give you that mass distribution. And then it's actually quite reasonable to expect this, if this mixing dominates in the decays of these guys. Any of these guys. So not the lightest dark sector particle, which would decay directly to two standard model particles, but something here that could decay, would be able to decay to the lightest fermion, the dark sector, plus two standard model. These decays, so for example, imagine your second lightest fermion going to the lightest fermion through an off-shell Higgs. And then this would produce a tau plus tau minus pair. This kind of decay, very naturally, when you put in the mass scales you need to explain these decays, gives you C tau of order a centimeter. And I mean, there's enough fudge that there's a good order of magnitude, two orders of magnitude fudge on that centimeter. But the fact that it gives you the right range is actually somewhat remarkable. And in fact, if you try to get displaced vertices from the sort of most natural range of the photon kinetic mixing, it's much harder. You need very, very, very small mixings in order to get centimeter displacements or from vector decays or from the three-body decays that I talked about. And you need very large kinetic mixings in order to get large scalar decay rates out of this operator. So bees can be kinematically squeezed out. Charm probably cannot. Depending on how that quartic mixing was generated, you might or might not have a preference for the down-type Higgs couplings anyway that would squeeze out the charm. That's probably consistent to throw in there. I think there's...
Coming back to these mass distributions, yeah. And you keep arguing that it can't be any kind of resonance based on the mass distribution, but with such complicated decays, couldn't that... and a lot of invisible energy floating around, you really can't get a spread out mass distribution?
If you have something like 70% of the energy, I mean, I just made up that number. It sounds very precise. But I just made it up.
You are Mr. Spock.
If you have about 3/4 of the energy going into a bunch of invisible particles, then maybe it's possible that you can get that kind of mass distribution for the rest of it. But, I mean, all of these things, you wouldn't reconstruct the full resonance mass, but it's basically the central limit theorem, right? If you have a big enough decay, you expect that adding up the masses of everybody going into it is going to be clustered around the mean. So if which will be some rescaled, some fraction times the production energy. So that's why I find it pretty implausible that this would really come, that you'd get this kind of shape from scaling down even a small fraction of the energy from a resonance. I have to admit I haven't played with it in these sort of large fraction missing energy regimes.
Well,
the other problem.
What if the width of this resonance was simply very big?
Yeah. So if it's an order one width, then you can probably start getting around it. That also helps to get around the other problem with resonances, which is that resonances you really do expect to see first in their decay back to the standard model.
Right. That's
unless you're pair, if you're pair producing something, you have some Z4 structure, you pair produce something with charge 2, and it decays to 2 things in the other sector, and I don't know what happens to the other one, but it's the decay products of a pair-produced thing that give you 2 cones.
I understand that. I mean, if you're producing a broad resonance, it's broad,
yeah.
Presumably because it's decaying into something other than the standard model, which then
yeah.
might chain decay to the standard
right.
model.
Right. No, I agree.
So that seems still okay in principle, right?
Yes. Although if it has you know less than 4π couplings to the other stuff, and the resonance searches are just so much better than paying any efficiencies to see 3 muons that.
Well, I think the resonance has to be very broad.
It has to be very broad, yeah.
Such a complicated array of possible decays, right?
Right.
And certainly this kind of model gives you quite an array, I would have thought. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, this is actually
still
the first
the
came
to
my mind when I saw these events, you know, it has to be produced, of course, so it's got to have
right.
2 q-bar of whatever couplings, and yet you can't see it in the usual detection modes, dielectrons or whatever, that there's strong limits on, and a way to do that is to just have it be unexpectedly broad, hugely spread out, still has a good production cross-section that might give you the kind of cross-section that you get.
Yeah, but although you can't
you know,
really... you can't really have the large production cross section without also having a sizable partial width, right?
Right.
Even if,
compare, but
yeah,
if, but we're arguing it has to be extreme, much broader than the normal resonance of this kind of mass, 200
yeah,
or whatever, or 50 or.
So you would have that
array.
Right.
Yeah,
that's
just
true.
A huge array of stuff, you know.
Yeah, it's also true that the limits on very broad resonances are much weaker.
Yeah, and also on unusual decays, you know. How many studies have been done of, you know, resonance searches in, you know,
oh, yeah,
7, 8 tau modes, whatever.
I completely agree. Although, you know, the...
I mean, the dominant two-part standard, I think it's worse than that. I mean, if you're saying that, you know, there's some partial width to two standard model particles, but if you have, you know, those might very well be jets, right? In
yeah,
fact, if you get enough cross-section, probably you need this resonance to couple directly to quarks or gluons. So it'll, and then these will be some broad enhancement of two jets. I doubt that there's any constraint on that.
Yeah, it can be. I mean, if you want to do something where it couples to jets and not to leptons, that obviously makes it much easier to evade these constraints. Anything that couples, I mean, we're talking about a nanobarn cross section in this final state. So there's a lot of searches with sort of picobarn sensitivity. LEP limits play a role if you think it has any sizable, unless you say it just couples to quarks or just couples to glue. Then you'd expect to see it in E plus E minus goes to E plus E minus, and these limits are quite a bit better. It's not, I'm not going to go so far as to say that it can't be done, but one of the intriguing things about the SUSY production kinds of stories is that, you know, by construction, there is no simple standard model final state. You can really have, you have large standard model couplings giving you the production cross-sections that you need, and no additional large couplings that would cause problems elsewhere, right? And then it's just a small coupling that leads to the decay of the LSP into something else. So it's sort of, it's the least of the least constrained kind of scenario you can envision. Even things like, I'm not sure what the broad resonance limits would be in detail. Okay, so. A bunch of things sort of work with this kind of coupling for the decays, which, independent of the production mode, I think is an interesting point. So you can just set the size of this coupling by demanding naturalness of the dark sector Higgs mass, the Higgs mass squared, which is, of course, just whatever the lambda v squared is in the dark sector, should not be any smaller than the Higgs mass that you generate from this thing by giving the Higgs of F, otherwise you have some R Higgs of F, so it has to be less than about lambda epsilon standard model Higgs of F squared. And that sets a lower bound on lambda epsilon, an upper bound on lambda epsilon, which is saturated if you imagine that this mass scale, the reason it's small is that it's set by symmetry breaking tied to its, right, its symmetry is broken by R electric symmetry breaking.
Isn't there also a constraint? I mean, that operator looks like hard SUSY breaking in the hidden sector.
Yes.
So there's some constraint just on how, you know, I mean, if you put a TEV cutoff on it.
I think I can get this operator just by integrating out some, if I have some link fields at a couple hundred GeV with some, you know, also SUSY breaking masses, then yeah, one can do it by integrating out a singlet at tree level, by integrating out link field fermions at loop level. I think there's a lot of very
level,
safe
yeah,
ways
I think,
to
I
generate
think you
this.
Do it at tree level, but loop level is probably enough. I think you can do it at
yeah.
Because at tree level, you're not going to get, you'd have to exchange something, it'd have to be something that.
Yeah, I agree. Or some bifundamental Higgs or something
yeah.
like that.
Okay. Anyway, that's fine.
But certainly, loop-level link fields seem like a nice way to generate this. Or you can just generate both at high scales in a SUSY preserving manner and make sure that the... And then it's just a question. It's a bit of a contrivance in that sector. How do you make sure that the particles decaying to the standard model do so dominantly through the Higgs mixing rather than and
I think you actually, and
weak couplings?
Maybe it's a detail, but
you
would actually generate... You generate it that way, that thing in a SUSY preserving way, either tree level or loops, I think you'd have more derivatives in there because it would be a Kähler term. It wouldn't come from some superpotential term. I would think it's gauge invariant.
SUSY preserving, you generate this just from the D-term mixing. Right?
But then why wouldn't that be...
So you generate
sort of
both of these
right.
from it in the same way. And then the integrating out would have to be proportional to the soft masses.
I believe that anything that would create the second term would also create some of the first term at a loop level.
Hmm. You say even integrating out the link fields, that's probably...
Yeah, because if HD and H mix, then they're diagrams that connect Z prime to Z via Higgs loops.
Yeah, no, I agree. So the question is whether you can have this be loop suppressed compared to that, or whether, in fact, whatever generates this at one loop is also generating that at one loop.
Right.
And I'm not really sure. So you may be forced to do the contrivance over here to make sure that this kind of decay dominates. There are also, certainly one can write down scalars. If you have a scalar, there's only an epsilon to the fourth suppressed decay through this operator, whereas there's a sort of epsilon squared suppressed decay here. So in that case, this operator 2 would naturally dominate, and you'd get a preference for the heavy flavor states. But on the other hand, the problem, apparent problem with that is something that Matt Strassler pointed out in this, as far as explaining the multi-muons, is that it should also decay directly to mu-mu pairs. So you'd expect when they do look at this massive mu-mu, mu plus mu-minus, you'd expect that in addition, it's sort of an amorphous blob out to 3 JeV or so with a tail. And you'd expect that you should also see, you should have some sort of 3 × 10⁻³ fraction of these things decaying to muons, and that should show up as a big resonance. And that simple numerology suggests that it would be very visible in this invariant mass plot. So probably that, although that's the simplest way of getting this Higgs-mediated decay to dominate, probably it's inconsistent with the mass plots. Now, Barbieri, Hall, Richkoff, and Strumi like to say that, well, actually, if you look at their plot, it shows a little excess right on the J-psi, and they sort of say you can hide a dimuon resonance under the J-psi, which I don't find very appealing. I'm not sure if they're saying you can hide it under the J-psi or if they're actually saying that the J-psi bump isn't a J-psi. It's really this. But I find the argument that you'd expect a resonance to be reasonably convincing. So I think the... If something's decaying to taus, it should, it really had better be 3-body taus plus something. Which, if that works, so then you get into the missing energy tail question. Even with taus, you get into a missing energy tail question. Probably it's hard to distinguish missing energy from taus from missing energy from taus plus dark matter or other metastable states. Yeah, so these decays, all I was going to say about them is that when you saturate this limit with the mass of the Higgs in the sort of 10 GeV neighborhood, that gives you a mixing angle between the Higgses of order some ratio of lambda dark to lambda standard model.
You mean M Higgs dark or M Higgs?
Ah, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. Right, this is of order the ratio of the Vebs cubed, and that gives you a two-body lifetime with this 10 GeV. I mean, it's a sixth power, so anything goes. But with this 10 GeV scale, you get two-body lifetimes for the Higgs going to two taus. If this were a dominant decay mode, that would be something like 10 microns. And the three-body decays through the kinds of for the fermions that I drew there really work out to be, just because they're suppressed by an extra coupling and loop factor, can very reasonably be right around the centimeter range. Again, with order of magnitude uncertainties from many sources. So this kind of so the SUSY picture can work pretty well to explain the kinematic features, and then the displacement and multiplicity features are all pretty consistent with this fermion into taus kind of story. Fermion into taus and slider fermions. So I don't know. I don't know if the I don't know if the signal is real. I don't know if it is real. It remains to be seen whether this kind of SUSY really in detail matches. But I think, well, first of all, it's not a ridiculous place to look for new physics. So I think the message is definitely, you know, clean it up. And it's a good thing that this reported discovery, true or not, got us thinking about it, because there could be a lot of new physics hiding in this kind of final state. But I think, to the extent that theorists thought about before, there was also a tendency to give up hope about it being discoverable. Maybe it's not that crazy to look here. And I'd even go further and say that it's pretty surprising that the qualitative agreement and some quantitative agreement in examples we've looked at between these sort of simple models or skeletons of models and the features, the most striking features of the signal, are somewhat remarkable. Either it's much easier than I thought to fit junk with with models. I mean, because this is really the sort of prototype of junk events, right? And I've tried to look at junk events before, and there's just no new physics that looks reasonable and matches the junk events. This is a pretty simple story, and every feature of the junk has a simple qualitative physics explanation. So I don't know. Maybe it's fooling me, but it's not crazy to me to think that these could be new physics. And if they are, then obviously it's a great discovery. And it's an opportunity to learn not just about SUSY breaking, but about something maybe more interesting than SUSY breaking, which is some, you know, the existence of a new low mass sector that you can probe in some detail. So this would be a really fun arena for physics. Now you have the high mass production physics, which is new, and the low mass decay physics, which is structurally more like hadronic physics today, but it's also new.
Well, we'll also see it right away at the LHC, even if we don't have vertexing, we'll see these multi-muon jets right away.
Yeah, well, so that, if this trigger bias thing is right, then that really depends on where your muon triggers are. If you have, in this kind of setup, because you're producing low-mass particles, the momentum wouldn't actually get that much higher. So The question is, what are, at an initial running, what are the PT thresholds on muon triggers going to look like?
I think we can probably run with 10 at the for the very first running.
10, Jeff? Nothing lower. Single muon?
Single.
What about dimuon?
Probably can go lower than that.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you really want, I think, dimuons in the range that CDF is looking at.
I can look it up, what they're talking about. You know, as the luminosity increases, you have to raise the thresholds.
Right. Yeah, the website, the wikis I was looking at, I don't know how out of date they were. They were saying that, you know, looked like it was saying zero, no PT cut for without prescale for CMS. Then the Atlas pages were saying like 5G VPD cuts. That makes a big difference.
What did they figure out? No. Muon requirement.
No, sorry. No zero PT requirement for the muon. Requiring two muons with no restriction on the PT.
Okay, with a restriction on the energy or what?
The one line of the wiki that I saw seems to indicate that it just has to be a muon in a central region.
To be announced.
This is, yeah. Yeah. This is one of the things I forgot to ask John about last time I was out here.
Well, I would suggest let's thank them, Natalia, and we'll thank you all for coming up. Welcome to join us.
Oh, yeah, of course. Thanks a lot.